Well, welcome Adam T. from L.A.
My name's Adam. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank the group, thank Neil, thank Jason, thank Jeremy for their hospitality. Thank you for inviting me to come talk. It's an honor and a privilege to be asked to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. Ultimately, it's a responsibility to give back what was so freely given to me. Welcome to anybody that's new. You know, if you're trying AA again, if you don't want to be here tonight, if you don't think this will work for you, if your sponsor made you come to this. You know, I didn't get to AA because I had a bad weekend. You know, I had a couple of bad decades. And for me, like a lot of us, eventually this becomes a matter of life and death. I live in Los Angeles. We have about 3,000 meetings a week in the greater LA area. I mean, it's this huge metropolis. And I stood up in AA for 17 years as a newcomer. It was just ridiculous. I mean, we know the drill, right? I had so many chips and key tags, could have played poker with them, right? No, I mean, really. I remember one secretary saying, give them back. And I did that walk of shame over and over and over again. And if you're new, I look back at that experience now and I thank God for the unconditional love of the old timers. You know, a lot of those old timers that aren't with us anymore, a lot of those guys that died with 30, 40 years sober and they saw me come in and out and they would say things to me like, don't even bother taking chips. Just sit in the back. Shut up. No, but in a loving way, right? But, you know, they made it really clear to me, and if you're new, I hope you hear this. They made it really clear to me that if and when I was ready, because somehow they could see it. They could see it by my demeanor, my lack of interest, my fidgety nature. Those old-timers had the wisdom to see just by my attitude that maybe it wasn't right now. But they made it really clear to me that if and when I was ready, that the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous would always be open to a drunk like me. And I think looking back at that experience now, next to my parents, if you're new, Alcoholics Anonymous is the closest thing to unconditional love that a drunk like me will ever experience. No matter how many people I burned, how many lives I destroyed, how many cars I wrecked, how many hearts I broke, how many jobs I lost, how many despicable, shameful things I did. And if you are, in fact, an alcoholic, it's the most shameful thing in the world to be the family drunk. Especially if you come from a large family like I do. My mom had three sisters and a brother. My dad, four brothers and a sister. And she told them everything, right, from the time I was in middle school. And I mean, even today, 25 years later, there's huge groups of people in my family that will never, ever talk to me again in this lifetime. That's how bad it was. And I mean, it's funny when you really think about that. One more rubber room, one more institution, right? One more overdose. Happy birthday, Dad. I'm in jail again. I mean, does anybody here relate to being paid not to come home on the holidays? I mean, that was my life. You know, I mean, it's funny, but it's like that high price we pay for this almost despicable, humiliating, low quality of life. Right? I was a straight A student. I was a top all my classes. I was an only child. Didn't come from a broken home. Mom and Dad were married almost 50 years. And they love me. You know the love parents have. Anybody's a parent, you see, like where I live, they block up the whole street. Right, to pick up their kids at the middle school. You know, we want to shoot them, right? Blocking traffic. But I know my mom and dad had all this love for me. I know, that's an LA thing, right? I know my mom and dad loved me. And to watch those two people, to watch my parents, they were good people, to watch them literally watch me burn my life to the ground. To witness that, to the point where eventually my mom had sold the family property, she moved. She didn't leave a forwarding address. That's where I left her. That was almost the final part of that relationship. That's really horrible. And despite all of that, degradation, humiliation, the doors of AA have always been open to people like me. If I lived to be 100 years old, I could never pay AA back. For the love and kindness, you know what some of you people have shown me. Not all. You like everybody in AA, you know what it means? It means you're not going to enough meetings. My sponsor said, you know, you don't really have to like anyone in particular here, but, you know, if you stick around for a while, you'll learn to love people. If you take the traditions off the wall and start applying them to relationships, what will happen is you'll learn to love people here you don't even like. You know, and what happened to me eventually, and I know we never hear this anymore, but eventually I started coming to meetings drunk. Now, the interesting thing about Alcoholics Anonymous 2023, if you actually see a drunk person in an AA meeting these days, people say stuff like, oh my gosh, what's he doing here? I mean, ironic as it is, we don't see a lot of wet alcoholics in AA, and I don't want to bash the therapeutic community. I saw the druggy buggy out there. But I mean, let's face it, right? Treatment now is a $35 billion industry, and they do a lot of good work. But, you know, for me, treatment would swoop me up in my most desperate moments, right? Throw me into yoga class. I mean, what the fuck am I doing? The downward dog, right?
Craft hour.
I'm making belt buckles and bongs. They don't know what to do with me, right?
Nature walks.
Please, I'm walking to 7-Eleven, getting a big gulp cup, filling it up with liquor, putting a little Coca-Cola on top, walking into the late night Hollywood candlelight meeting, doing some of my best sharing. I mean, funny, but, you know, true. I mean, if you're new, we have a chapter in the big book, the chapter to wives. Anybody read the chapter to wives? I never read it. I never had a wife. I mean, none of my very own, right? But if you read the chapter to wives, because it's very instructional, it talks about four types. It enumerates them. Type 1, type 2, type 3. And the fourth type of alcoholic that's described in the chapter to wives is a type of alcoholic that's been placed in one institution after another. Sound familiar? Type of alcoholic that typically drinks on his way home from the hospital. Sound familiar? And even though I had been in one of the largest AA groups in the world, I still became that fourth type. By the time I finally got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd gone through residential treatment for alcoholism 28 times. And I'm not bragging, not 28 days like the movie. This isn't Hollywood. 28 consecutive times, and I'm wearing that like some kind of ridiculous badge of honor. I remember telling my sponsor I went through treatment 28 times. I was hoping that would get rid of the guy. You know, loser. Go find someone that's willing. But I didn't want to ruin his batting average. Idiot. And he starts laughing at me like this. I'm like, it's not very funny. And he says, you know, going through treatment 28 times, that doesn't make you an alcoholic. And I thought, you're kidding. He says, oh no, that just means you paid $500,000 for a big book. And I didn't think that was funny. And I'm not going to start citing and quoting pages tonight out of the big book. But page 101 of the big book says any scheme that attempts to shield the alcoholic from temptation is doomed to failure. See, treatment was a great place to fat me up for another run. Treatment has its rightful place in recovery. Treatment probably saved my life. Even Bill Wilson had gone to treatment. In fact, if you ever wonder what all the treatment centers and religions do have in common, it's obvious. They all send their drunks to us. Dr. Silkworth says, we favor hospitalization or treatment for the alcoholic that's befogged or jittery. Some people don't go through treatment. It's not a prerequisite for AA. But if you're like me, my experience showed me that treatment never solved the problem. And as an alcoholic, like a lot of us, I always thought the problem was liquor. I thought it was alcohol. And I remember someone in AA saying to me, Adam, if alcohol's your problem, that drink, that shot glass, that 12-pack, that little glass of Chardonnay, if that's your problem, you're probably not an alcoholic. And then he paused, and in the very next breath, he said to me, and if you are in fact an alcoholic, the type that's described in the doctor's opinion, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, your problem is an alcohol. And I'm like, what? It took another decade for me to understand what he was trying to tell me. It was almost like some kind of cruel riddle. I drank over that for years. It went right over my head. Right over my head. But we talk about what happened. We use that word. What happened? One of the things that happened to me is I got around a group of big book enthusiasts. People in Alcoholics Anonymous that took the statements in the big book, turned them into questions, and directed the questions at me. Very simple ideas like, was I incapable of being honest with myself when it came to alcohol? Huh. Did I drink because I liked the effect produced? Duh, that's a no-brainer, right? How about this? Was I restless, irritable, and discontent by nature? Powerful question. Was that my natural state before my lips ever touched alcohol? Was my greatest obsession that somehow, someday, I would control and enjoy my drinking at the same time? And the last piece, did I pursue that illusion, meaning just out of reach, to the gates of insanity and death? And as I went through those considerations, if you're new, if you're like me, for the first time I saw the truth. And the most obvious truth, what we call the external unmanageability, was crystal clear from the time I was a teenager. I was in eighth grade. I was already pissing in my pants. I was already drooling on my desk. I was already passed out under the bleachers. I overshot the mark from the first time I ever drank. My nickname in eighth grade was Space Cadet. I couldn't find homeroom. I mean, really, people are picking high schools. I'm already picking rehabs, right? But if you're new tonight, alcoholism comes in people. It doesn't come in bottles or six-packs or 12-packs or kegs or shot glasses or little baggies. Alcoholism comes in people. And the greater aspect of this spiritual illness, as Bill Wilson describes it, centering in my mind, if going through the considerations in the big book shows me anything at all, it shows me that an alcoholic of my type, an alcoholic of this type, cannot really live without alcohol, not successfully, not happily. And part of what it really means for me to be an alcoholic, if I'm honest about my relationship with liquor, if I look at my history, is that I have a mind that will continue to take me back to getting loaded. Every time I get released from an emergency room, a hospital, a fancy Malibu treatment center, right? Men's Central Jail, 5743, roll it up. It's amazing to me. I'm sitting in, you know, county jail, casually reading a novel, not a cloud on the horizon. And I hear that number, 5743, roll it up. And I have this visceral compulsion in me that is so powerful. It's so powerful that I can't even stop at the release module for my property. Sound familiar? Suddenly, I hear that number like Pavlov's dog, and I have this compulsion in me that is so powerful. And then I come to an AA meeting, and these well-meaning people say things to me like, well, don't drink no matter what. I'm like, what happened to page 24? I'm literate, where it says every alcoholic passes through the state where even the strongest desire is of absolutely no avail. It says my willpower will become virtually non-existent. And Bill talks about a world of ignorance and misunderstanding surrounding alcoholism. You think that doesn't happen here? When I hear a statement, which is really a complete disregard for that first step, don't drink no matter what, and I know they mean well, and maybe for them it's true. That first paragraph in the fourth chapter, if you can stop when you want to, or you can control the amount you drink, you're probably not one of us. When I hear that statement, don't drink no matter what, from well-meaning people, I have to translate that, if you're new, to go to meetings no matter what, work steps no matter what, maintain commitments no matter what, develop the discipline of steps 10, 11, and 12 no matter what. And for the first time in my life, just like the doctor's opinion says, this person that seemed absolutely doomed is suddenly easily able to control his desire for alcohol. What a powerful thing that is. And I know we hear about the industry saying AA has no evidence-based results. I'm like, really? Why don't you go to a world convention? Check out like 85,000 100,000 alcoholics converging on a random city every 5 years. And it's amazing. When you see, and by the way, you have to make effort to do that. Maybe a plane ticket. Can't get it with your insurance. You got to get a rent a car, hotel room, right? Probably a conference ticket. They don't pay for that. But when they do the out-of-towners at a world convention, it's amazing. It like takes 2 hours. It looks like the United Nations. Every continent, every country, every city, every township. It's amazing. And for every one of those people, again, that have made that effort, you'll see a father, a daughter, son, a mom, an uncle. You'll see a world of people. For every one of us that has walked through this path, you'll see a world of people that will stand behind them and say, AA is the most powerful thing in my loved one's life. You know, it's funny because I didn't want to get into this tonight, but the Big Book is still on the top 88 books in the United States Library of Congress that shaped America. It's still there. It has affected the lives of somewhere between 30 to 40 million people worldwide. And you know why I don't think it's going to work for me? Because it wasn't my idea. But the results are there. I have to look at the evidence. My sponsor said, it doesn't matter who's wrong. It doesn't matter who's right. It just matters who's left. And when I look at people with 10, 20, 30 years sober that have amazing lives, that are chasing their dreams, that have relationships that work, that have learned how to navigate around the drama, that have learned how to stay in fit spiritual condition, what happened is I started to become aware of that. I remember my sponsor standing in front of me, in front of a hospital, and saying, how free do you want to be? You want to be free enough to just survive this? So when people say, how you doing? You can say, I'm hanging in there. He goes, I'll buy you a drink just out of mercy. Or he said, do you want to be free enough to chase your dreams? And I saw something in that home group. I saw something in this group of people that was, there's a word called enthusiasm. The word actually means filled with the Spirit of God. Never knew that it meant that. And I started to understand. There's certain things. I'm not going to get into this because it gets a little like Oxford groupy, which we could save for another time. But Alcoholics Anonymous has a systematic approach to showing me how to be rid of the things that are blocking me from a spiritual experience. And it's almost like I take actions I don't yet believe in. And over a period of time, it completely shifts my perception of reality. It's like telling a 5-year-old kid, go in your room and straighten out your room. He doesn't want to do it. Anybody got kids? You tell that same 5-year-old kid, go in your room, throw out all your old stuff. We'll go buy you brand new stuff. Kid be in there 2 minutes. What if it was really true? That I could discover these things that are blocking me. It's like when they asked Michelangelo how he made the statue of David. He said, I never really made the statue of David. I just chipped away everything that wasn't David, and there he was. This idea to face and be rid of the things in me that are blocking me. So if you're like me, what it really, really means to be an alcoholic is that I seem to have this mind that will continue to take me back to drinking. It's almost like my default program, like on a computer. And I was talking to Jason on the way over here. Our area now is called Silicon Beach. And he was saying, this is Silicon Valley. But the thing about it is that where I live, we got about 250 tech companies that have taken over our city, right? So Yahoo, Snapchat, Google, they're all there. And, you know, a lot of the guys that work for those companies come to our meetings. They're smart. Here's some math for the smart people. Potential plus alcoholism equals zero. It's like the quadratic formula. Balanced on zero. So a lot of these guys I've had the privilege of sponsoring, you know, they speak in Python and Java and they write code and they design hardware and software and they're engineers, very, very smart, far my intellectual superior, but they're alcoholic. And we talk about the language that Bill Wilson uses in 1939 and how really advanced that was. Because today we use the word program all the time. It wasn't so common in 1939. But if you look at the definition, what is the definition of the word program? You're looking at it. It is a sequential set of instructions, right? With a purpose designed to do what? Bring about a result. Now listen to the parallel language. What do you do when you get a corrupt file on the computer? Well, it's obvious. You put in a recovery disk. And what is the function of that disk? It restores the program to an earlier point in the process. The original self, if you will. It's like our spirits are like a body of water. When they're perfectly still, they best reflect the heavens. Right? Think about it. It never occurred to me that 10 and 11 become like the viral scan. If you really think about it, what actually happens if I follow these spiritual instructions? When I get to 10, I start to become mindful. I start to become accountable. I start to become transparent. I'm able to see where I paint the red flags green, right? And it's giving me some very, very simple instructions. How can promptly, and by the way, promptly means if you're going to eat crow, wouldn't you want to do it while it's still warm? How can promptly, quickly, immediately, at once mean at the end of the day? Look at the language. To bookend my day when I retire at night and upon awakening, to look at my selfishness, my dishonesty, my resentment, my fear. And to understand what those are. Not everyone has to do any of this. A lot of people can get away with doing very little here. But my experience is if I don't take these very specific, precise actions, what happens is I spiritually deteriorate. My own mother looks at me and says, "For God's sake, son, drink. You were nicer. Have a cigarette while you're at it." It never occurred to me when Bill Wilson talks about principles before personalities that it was our founder's future hope that these spiritual instructions, these guidelines would have more impact than, and I hate to say the hysterical, untethered opinions in the rooms, because I love AA. I love the fellowship. I love hanging out, going to Denny's, right? I mean, what do we do? Birthdays, weddings, even the funerals, you know. But it says it in the second chapter. It says the fellowship is but one element in the powerful cement that binds us. And there's a warning there. It said it would have never held us together as we are now joined. See, for me, the fellowship gives me enthusiasm. It gives me inspiration. It gives me encouragement, right? Hope, brotherly love. Some people are actually getting relationships and employment here now. Right? But if you unleash a character like me into a large group of people like this without guiding principles, you know what happens, right? My character defects thrive. I actually get sicker in the fellowship without guiding principles. And what that looks like if you're new is somehow I become more separate, more different, and more alone. And if you haven't heard that terminology, what that means is separated from God. It means different than every single person here. We've heard it, right? It's called terminal uniqueness. And alone, you know that loneliness, that ache in the heart of every one of us that has nothing to do with the proximity or closeness of other people. That loneliness at the core of my soul. In fact, the bigger the crowd, the worse it is. My own birthday, my own wedding, I still feel alone. That loneliness at the core of my soul that I can't talk about when I hit that pillow at night. If you have that like I do, what that is my inability to connect. And you put a couple of drinks in me, I'm calling people from fifth grade saying, "I love you." Oh, I go right into amends. Right? See, alcohol creates the illusion that my life is manageable. It does so much for me, I don't care what it's doing to me. And that's what the earth people can't understand about us. They can't figure out why we drink. We can't figure out why y'all don't. And right next to being separate, different, alone, there is this almost parallel interface. These three fundamental ideas in recovery. The first is to be protected by some kind of God. The second, to be accepted by self. And the third, to be connected to a community. Three fundamental ideas. And you hear it in a vision for you, right? Abandon yourself to God as you understand God, 1 through 3. Admit your faults to him and your fellows, 4 through 7. Clear away the wreckage of your past, 8 and 9.
Right? And I start to see that. I start to see what that is. To abandon myself to God. You abandon a ship, you can't get back on it. I go to the ocean with a cup, I get a cup full of water. What if I go to the ocean with my whole life? You know, someone was just talking about all the way in, sit all the way down. And you hear it in every meeting. When we talk about chapter 5, which we didn't read tonight. But in, you know, it says we ask for his care and protection with complete abandon. That first piece. The second piece, to be accepted by self. And if you're new, what that meant to me is in steps 4 through 7, I no longer need internal or external validation. I develop over a period of time what's called an internal locus of control. You can look that up on your phone after the meeting. No, because it's important. It's a clinical term, but it's something that happens here. And the third piece, to be connected to a community. Protected by God, accepted by self, and connected to a community. And I go from being the weakest link in my family. And I'm talking about generations of suicide, mental illness, and alcoholism. To 25 years later, the strongest link in that family tree. That's why when we talk about the view from the center of AA is entirely different than it is from the outside. It is said that alcoholism is the only disease, and it's predicated by the word spiritual. The only disease, when treated, that will actually leave the sufferer in a better position than if they never had the disease. I'd have never believed that. Because I had fellowship-driven recovery, I would never believe that. Until that day when he said that to me, how free do you want to be? And what happened for the first time in my life is I became willing to take actions in Alcoholics Anonymous that I did not yet believe in. And those actions over a period of time, just like alcohol changed my perception of reality, the fundamental idea of these steps was to change the lens through which I saw my life, and I never saw it. I never saw that till much later. And I look at 17 years of failure, even in, like I said, one of the largest groups in the world. And if you're new, what I see looking back at that now is my defiance towards spiritual principles. In the original manuscript in this book, as we were talking about the big book, it used to say, rarely have we seen a person fail that's thoroughly followed our directions. Now, if you're like me, I don't like directions. Oh, come on, I don't even want to be told not to do something I already don't want to do, right? That's my nature. I will argue with anybody about anything at any time. You tell me it's black, I'll tell you it's white. You tell me it's big, I'll tell you it's small. You tell me to go left, I'll go right with an attitude. Oh, yeah, and then I'll blame you for eternity. That's why we say denial's an acronym. It stands for don't even notice I am lying. Think about it. You could tell an alcoholic, you can't tell them much. Oh, you don't believe it? Try sponsoring somebody. And what that means is you can lead me into the gates of hell, but you can't push me into heaven. And if you're new, when we talk about attraction rather than promotion, what that meant to a drunk like me is eventually I would come back to Alcoholics Anonymous on my own terms. Not because sober living wanted me to, not because my parole officer thought it was a good idea, not because DCSF sent me here. Right, where I live in LA, they all get sober for the trust fund. Right? I'm sure you got a couple trust fund babies here. It's harder. But see, if you're new, my experience is that hope doesn't matter to a drunk like me until I'm hopeless. You think hope matters to me when I got $1 million left in the bank, brand new truck, Harley, little boat down in the marina? Right? You wouldn't catch me dead in an AA meeting. And my experience is that God didn't matter to me until my back was against the wall. And I can remember, this isn't gutter bravado. I got in a little argument, got shot, it went directly through me, got a big hole through me, and I'm laying on the gurney. I got the paramedics over me with the paddles. All I know is God. I mean, if you've ever been in a situation like that, there's only two things men cry for, or people, mommy and God. That's it. And it's so funny because, you know, If you're drunk like me, I remember having my head in the toilet every morning, right? Steering the porcelain bus, puking my guts out every morning, right? Dope sick for the addicts. And I got my head in that toilet every morning. Who prays more than drunks like us? Come on. You don't relate. You might be in the wrong room. And I'm not being divisive. But what's so interesting about that is Bill Wilson talks about in his story, he talks about having this powerful white light experience. And on the very next page, it says it was quickly blotted out by worldly clamors, most of which were where? Within himself. I can remember sitting in that cardiologist's office in the emergency room. He'd put a tampon all the way through me because to stop the bleeding. And he runs this cord through my groin. It's called an angiogram. And he pumps the dye onto the TV screen. And he says, the bullet missed. I was like drunk in half an hour. As soon as he told me he'd missed the artery coming out of my heart, I was immediately like, I need to get out of here. I'm going to be fine. I got to get a drink. That's why if you're new tonight, there's a huge difference between the act of surrender that gets a newcomer into the rooms of AA over and over and over again, and the state of surrender that's keeping the old timers here. It's a completely different concept. It's kind of like watching a swan glide across a pond of still water. So beautiful, right? It's so effortless, so graceful. You know what the swan's doing under the water, right? Paddling like hell. And if you're new, we have a chapter in the big book, Into Action. Have you ever noticed there's no chapter into feelings? I know, I always have the therapist run up to me after the meeting. Oh, into thinking. How about into whining from the podium at the noon meeting? I'm like, dude, get a job, bro. That'll help. So, you know, there's a therapy out there called cognitive behavioral therapy. It's expensive. In AA, it's a dollar. And it's a sliding scale. And it's basically saying you can't think your way into right living, but I can live my way into right thinking. My sponsor told me, take the triangle recovery, unity, and service and turn it into three actions. Contribute, belong, and learn. It's such a simple idea. And what's so interesting about that is like if there was a weight pile in the middle of this room and every day I drive iron for an hour, will I get strong? Absolutely. Does it matter how I feel about it? So my sponsor said, the more that I take commitments in AA meetings, the more I'll feel needed. The more I stand at the door and I say, hi, I'm Adam, the more that I'm going to know people in Alcoholics Anonymous. See, I can't separate cause from effect. The more that I uncover, discover, and discard that which is blocking me from God, self, and others, the more that I will start to have these bilateral relationships. It's a very simple idea. The steps bring me wisdom. The fellowship where two or more gather bring me power. And by reaching back in my community, altruistically being of service, for the first time I can give and receive love. I'll simplify it. My head, my heart, and my feet need to be moving in the same direction. And what's so powerful about that is over a period of time, I started to feel wanted, needed, and loved in every area of my life. It was just that simple. That was the byproduct of the actions I was asked to take in Alcoholics Anonymous. Very, very powerful. So what happened to me? We always say, what happened? I got to one more treatment center, right? 120 pounds. Thank God we don't look like our stories, right? It's probably why they ask us to dress up. I'm 120 pounds. I stink like urine. My fingers are dirty. I'm missing a couple teeth. You know how we look, right?
A vision for you.
I mean, I look like a concentration camp victim, but I got washboard abs, right? And I'm sitting there in the treatment center in my nightgown with my ass hanging out, judging the speaker. It's so funny how we're the only people that could literally be on the curb and still look down at the world. I know what you're thinking, druggy buggy people.
But you're homeless. Homeless. No offense. So, right, I got two speeds, grandiose and comatose. And I'm strutting around the detox bragging about Robin Brink's trucks. I finally did my four step. It was a bread truck. And it was empty. So I'm sitting there in the treatment center with my fellow associates, and this woman comes in on what was called an H&I panel. We were talking about that earlier tonight. H&I, in some parts of the country, it's treatment and corrections, but H&I in our area stands for hospitals and institutions. We also call it homies and inmates, right? But it's a committee that brings meetings into prisons, treatment centers, detoxes, hospitals, anywhere where clients, patients, or inmates can't get the meetings. Our H&I on the west side of LA is like as big as this. It's about 300 people. And they're fighting each other to get on panels to talk to people in treatment centers that don't care. But it probably has one of the lowest relapse rates in all of recovery. The people that make the effort, the most cohesive group of people, the same people 20 years later are doing the prison panels and the hospitals and the treatment centers and the psych wards. So I'm in this treatment center. I'm a patient. This woman comes in. She's on the panel. She does her AA talk. At the end of her talk, she looks us all up and down and she says, "If I could give you all the gift of recovery, I wouldn't do it." And I'm like, I looked at her. I looked at the guy next to me and I remember saying it. I said, "What a bitch." No disrespect. And then she said something that would later change my life. She said, "The reason I wouldn't give you the gift of recovery, the reason I wouldn't give it to you is because I wouldn't rob you of the journey." And all these years later, if you're new, I've come to understand that that journey to recovery, just like that journey to surrender, we can't give it to you. It's personal. And again, I don't want to be divisive, but if you're in a hot tub with a supermodel, a fifth of whiskey and an eight ball, and daddy sends you to rehab, we don't expect you to be happy. I mean, that's retarded. I mean, fun with problems, just problems. Imagine getting interrupted in the middle of a case of beer in the fun with problem stage. It's horrible. Right? I mean, think about it. It's magic, medicine, misery. And I was here way too early. I remember being 17 years old in AA. There were no young people. And the old timers were like, "You know what, kid, we spilled more than you drank." We're like, "You know what, pops, we didn't spill any. That's why we got here sooner." I know. I'd rather step on your toes in your grave. I don't care. I needed to hear the truth. You know, we talk about, "Oh, my worst day sober is better than my best day drinking." Are you out of your mind? Come on. That's just disturbing. But my worst day sober is better than my last day drinking, right? Think about that. That last couple years where the disease is killing you every day and it won't bury you. That's what purgatory is. We were discussing that on the way over here. I don't drink, I suffer. I drink, you suffer. I don't work the steps, we all suffer. I have to understand what this is. What is it to be an alcoholic? There's something much greater here than just the substance. It's this spiritual maladjustment that I suffer with. If I don't understand what the problem is, the solution's not going to work. That gift of desperation that she talks about, it's a great acronym for God. The gift of desperation. But what happened to me is I had to drink past that. I got to a place where my head couldn't get enough and my body couldn't take anymore. You ever seen that kind of drinking? Skid Row's full of people like that. You got people like that all living under these bridges here. When my head can't get enough and my body can't take anymore, God means something totally different to a drunk like me. It means grow or die.
Then my hand's going to be forced. This isn't a choice at that point. Right? It talks about having these two alternatives. Go on to the bitter end, right? Blotting out the consciousness of my intolerable situation. And what's the other alternative? Oh, accept spiritual help. Doesn't say stop drinking. Faced with alcoholic destruction or to live on a spiritual basis. You think it would be simple. Do a survey. Costco, jails, institutions, and death. Happy, joyous, and free. It's a no-brainer. You step over to my cell in Men's Central Jail, you ask me that question, I'm thinking, how bad an alcoholic death? Can I talk to my counselor, my therapist, my MFT, my counselor, get back to you on Monday? And I will justify, minimize, and rationalize my right to drink. The first half of step one, me defending my right to drink. The rest of my life, defending my right to play God. There's a saying, God can't use a man or woman till they come to the end of themselves. And what I didn't understand, if you're new, is that for a lot of us, the bottom's the same. From Yale to jail, Park Avenue to Park Bench, the illustration, the bottom is really the same. It's two elements. When I ask for help, right? That's the first one. And the second is when I'm actually willing to receive it. Do you know how many people come to AA looking for help? If everyone walked through the door of this place, you'd be in a stadium. And I'll simplify it. I throw you a life raft, and you look at it, and you say, I was looking for a blue one. How do you work with someone like that?
I really don't like the way you threw it, bro.
Have you ever sponsored someone like that? It's kind of funny. It sounds like comical, but it's like, then you bury him. It's like horrible. Brutal. It's so funny. We're the only people that want a reward because we ran out of a burning building. I mean, if you're feeling heroic because you gave up your big night in Provo to hang out with us. This is the only place on God's earth where they'll applaud because you came in to save your own life.
You're wondering when the miracle's going to happen?
You're in an AA meeting Saturday night. It's happened. I mean, we've all heard this. My sobriety is God's gift to me. What I do with it, my gift to God. There's three prayers in this life. The first one, God help me. The second prayer, God give me. Greatest distraction on earth. Prayer I'd never said was, God use me. And Neil calls me. I know. And I got a sweatshirt. And I love you for it. I had a good lunch. And maybe the opportunity to help one human being. Maybe one human being. That will find a way to have a joyous second half. I've seen so many people have amazing lives in Alcoholics Anonymous because they became teachable. I just heard a woman today, and she was talking about hating AA and not liking it and being resistant. And this wino came into her meeting. And a couple weeks later, he started to wear clean clothes. And a couple weeks later, he has a job. And a couple months later, he's doing better than her. He said, there's got to be a God. You know, it's the observation. You watch people here. You cannot deny it. When Ebby sat in front of Bill and said there was no more power in him than me, but he could not deny that Ebby Thatcher had been inwardly reorganized. That he said, I saw a miracle sitting right in front of me. It is undeniable. Einstein said, I would rather live my life pretending there's a God and finding out there isn't than live my life pretending there's no God and finding out there is. That's Pascal's wager. But when you look at the evidence, you look at thousands and millions of people that have recovered. You know, it's indisputable. If you can step back from this, if you're new, and look at it. My sponsor said, buy a black suit. And I said, why? And he said, well, you're going to go to a lot of funerals. He said, it might come in handy. And then he laughed and he goes, and if you get loaded again, at least we'll have something nice to bury you in. Oh, brutal. Mean, heartless. But see, if you baby the alcoholic, I'll bury him. I needed to hear the truth about alcoholism. It's fatal. It's progressive. It's chronic. We talk about jails, institutions, and death like hamburgers, fries, and a Coke. They go together. But see, if you're like me, I live in a world of delusion. I cannot differentiate the true from the false. And again, I don't want to bash the therapeutic community, but going through treatment 28 times, I started to speak a foreign language in treatment, and they endorsed it. It's called victimese. Somehow I don't understand how the drug bone connects to the jail bone. Like, I need a class for that? Relapse prevention. It's kind of like I met her in rehab. I can't believe she drank. Really? Duh.
I knew he was a crackhead. I can't believe he stole my iPhone.
Jesus. And if you do inventory, it's real clear. It says how I make decisions based on self that later leave me in a position to be hurt. If I do not connect those dots through the process of inventory, I will continue to play victim. There's only one problem with that. Victims don't get sober. It begged for me to have responsibility in this area. And Bill talked about fear sobering up for a bit. Fear was not enough for me. Getting a third strike, living on the street, being homeless, losing my career. Did scared straight work for you? It went right over my head. And the book's interesting because it talks about the problem drinker and really illustrates the problem drinker as someone that can stop or moderate given sufficient reason. There's a big difference between someone like me and a problem drinker. Think about it. You get a problem drinker and a real alcoholic in a drunk tank. You know the rubber rim for drunk driving? You got two completely different philosophies going on. You got the problem drinker over here on one side of this cell thinking, why'd I drink so much last night? I knew I shouldn't have drank so much. Why didn't I take Uber? Real alcoholics on the other side of the cell thinking, why'd I take I-15? Now the court card people never laugh at that. That's not funny, right? You should have took Surface Streets. You could have been home cleaning your pipe tonight. Problem drinker's wife says, you don't stop drinking, I'm leaving you. Problem drinker cleans up his act, doesn't drink in the house, gets a little Visine. Now, if my woman says, you don't stop drinking, I'm leaving you, you know what I'm thinking, right? I'm thinking about single life. And see, if you're new, that was my relationship with alcohol. If anything got in the way of booze, it was out of my life. I mean, alcohol had me from hello. It completed me. It was the love of my life. You think I'm going to let go of the love of my life without a fight? I can't even let go of a bad relationship. Everything I let go of, there's claw marks all over it. And if you're new, my relationship now with AA is the same. If anything gets in the way of Alcoholics Anonymous for me, it's out of my life. A woman, I don't care how beautiful she is, how in love we are, my soulmate. I remember the first time I said that in a meeting. There she was in the back of the room. She's like, God, Adam, you don't look like an alcoholic. Oh, please. You know, why you got to go to all those meetings, sweetheart? All the time? You're not speaking again, are you? It's the weekend. Then she tells me, you know that AA program, it's getting in the way of our relationship. So a couple months later, we're still dating. Now it's the big night. You know the big night, meet the parents night. That's a big one. Gets me a suit and tie, brings me to mom and dad's house, head of the table, out comes the exotic wine. She's like, honey, you can have one glass of wine. Wait a second, it's just a glass of wine, one glass. It's a toast. It's natural wine. Oh yeah, four more rehabs. I stole her purse that night. Went down to the hood and got an outside issue. And she came to detox with a get well card. Poor girl. I know. She qualified for another program. I tried to send her to Codependence Anonymous. She wouldn't go. You know why? She didn't have anyone to go with. I can always tell the Al-Anons, they don't think any of this is funny, right? Can't stand to see us have a good time even here.
I saw the Al-Anon literature up there. I'm sorry. Call your sponsor. So my mom had gone to Al-Anon, and the Al-Anon humor from that side, they say, you know how many Al-Anons it takes to screw in a light bulb? None. The Al-Anon detaches and lets it screw itself. Redeemed. So when I had 5 years sober, I came back in my mom's life. At that time, I had a job, I had a home, I had a car, had a relationship. I came back into her life to help her, to be there for her as she got older. And I had been able to take the traditions off the wall through a workshop and learn how to apply these ideas to our family. Our common welfare comes first, our relationship as a family, as a couple, as a group, as a race, depend on our unity. Right? For our family's purpose, for our group's purpose, right? There's a loving God as he expresses himself, right? Our leaders don't govern. That means we don't dominate each other, right? Unless you're into that sort of thing. But it's about a democratic process. And I started to learn how to apply these ideas. Do we have a genuine desire to be together as a family, as a couple? So powerful. See, intimacy, like autonomy, is not two people looking at each other. It's two people playing different instruments to the same music. The ability to have that freedom in a relationship is so powerful. You know, I didn't understand what outside issues meant until someone said to me, you know, I can get along with a communist if I talk about food, music, and kids, but if I talk about politics, I'm done. So what happened with my mother is she loved music, she loved art, she loved dancing, she loved history. The woman could cook. So what I did is I invested the time to be interested in what she was interested in. And my mom became my best and closest friend for the last 10 years of her life. I learned how to do it. Just like in every relationship. If a relationship is 90% great and 10% bad, I'll burn it to the ground trying to fix the 10%. That's what we do. I have a fault-finding mind. What Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me is 90% is really good. Work on the 90%. You know, my dad was the same. I hated my dad. Hated my dad. And when I wrote the inventory, I blamed my father for all my failures. And I had to go through this process with him in the sense that I had to look at how he grew up. And what I discovered is when my dad was 5 years old, Hitler was bombing London. My grandmother was hiding my dad under tables while they were bombing that city. At 9, she died of cancer. He was a little boy. They put him in a camp. By 14, my father joined the military. They were taking kids back then and fought in the Korean War. And I'm expecting this guy to treat me like Mr. Brady, which now would be Family Guy. If you don't know who that is, go to Hulu. But I had no concept. So one of the exercises in the big book, it says we realize the people who offended us, right, were perhaps also spiritually sick. Although we didn't like their symptoms, column two, or the way it disturbed us, column three, like ourselves were sick too. My sponsor said, in order to prove that statement, everywhere you have a resentment, you have to ask yourself if you're capable of the same behavior. That's the only, just like in a geometry equation, because it's like ourselves. That means if I resent you for gossiping, did I ever gossip? If I resent you for lying, did I ever lie? If I resent you for stealing, did I ever steal? I may not steal your money. I can steal emotionally, spiritually, socially. I can steal someone's life by being in a relationship that I'm not really in it. So with my father, I resented my dad for abandoning me. And here was the question. Did I ever abandon anyone I loved for my true love, alcohol? And there it was. I'd abandon everybody. And there's a lie behind it. There's a place where it says dishonest. It's not the lies I tell you. The lie I have to tell myself to stand on that resentment is my father's love for me should have been more powerful than his alcoholism. And once I got that peace, I got free. Forgiveness is releasing someone from the prison of my own mind. It has nothing to do with him. But behind forgiveness is compassion. Behind compassion is empathy.
One of the most powerful exercises I ever did. My dad became my dearest and closest friend. I was just talking to those guys. They're doing a National Guard thing at the hotel I'm at. And I said, my dad would sit on a hand grenade for me. I am 100%, and I would do the same. There's nobody on this earth that loves me like him. And one day my dad looked at me and he says, son, I'm so sorry I wasn't there for you when you were a little boy. And that was it. The healing was just so powerful. Now I'm going to rephrase it for the millennials, and this is going to be on tape. We realize the people who traumatized us were also perhaps spiritually sick. Although we did not like their symptoms, column two, the way it disturbed us, column three, like ourselves, we're sick too. Anything that harms, threatens, or interferes with my safety falls under that definition. The outcome is the same. If I can be rid of this, I can get free. It says that alcoholism is the only prison where the key's inside. And if you're new, in order to be released from that, I had to let someone in that cell. There's only a little bit of time left. I'll say this. If someone did to me what I did to myself, I would have killed them. If someone did to me what I did to others, I would have killed them. Then I come to AA and you want me to pray to God. I didn't want God to find out where I was. I was bankrupt in those really simple relationships. You're new. If you really look at the steps by design, they remedy those three relationships. Steps 1 through 3, recreate and develop a relationship with God. 4 through 7, recreate and develop a relationship with self. 8 and 9, recreate and develop a relationship with others. It's a very simple idea. 10 maintains, develops, and grows my relationship with self. 11 maintains, develops, and grows my relationship with God. 12 through service maintains, develops, and grows my relationship with others. So coming out of the steps, a selfish, self-centered drunk like me is not only easily able to control my desire for alcohol, that's right in the doctor's opinion, but for the first time in my life, I'm able to live in harmony with God, self, and others. There was a great spiritual teacher. He was asked, what's the most important thing of all your teachings? He said, love God with all thy heart. Love thy neighbor as thyself. And you know what? If God scares you out of AA and you're a real drunk, don't worry about it. Booze will scare you back in. So in 1 through 3, I give it up. 4 through 7, I clean it up. 8 and 9, I make it up. 10, 11, and 12, I keep it up. Simple, straightforward idea. One of the oldest stories in AA is about this little 5-year-old boy, and he wants to play with his dad, and the dad's trying to occupy this little boy. And years ago, we used to have a thing called a map. And a map is a piece of paper, before Google Earth stole it from us, that has a picture of the world on it. So this dad grabs a magazine called National Geographic, which is another archaic thing, and he rips this map up of the world into like 100 pieces. He gives it to his little son. He gives the boy some tape. And he says, what I want you to do is I want you to put this map of the world back together. And when you're done, we'll play. And he's thinking it's going to take this little kid an hour. Little boy comes back in 5 minutes. He's got the whole map of the world taped back together. The dad's like, that's impossible. I'm like 50 years old. I couldn't do that. How'd you do it, young man? And the little boy says, Dad, it was so simple. On the back of the map of the world, there was a picture of a man, a person. I put the map, the man back together, and the whole world fell into place. And if you're new, that seems to be the spiritual technology of AA. To rebuild the man or woman or person, 1 through 3 with God, 4 through 7 with self through inventory, 8 and 9 with others through amends, and then to maintain, develop, and grow those simple ideas. The doctor's opinion talks about restless, irritable, and discontent by nature. And what I never understood is that's the mind, body, and spirit. See, it's the mind that's irritable. It's the body that's restless. It's the spirit that's discontent. I think we have a new word for restless, right? What is it? Oh, ADD. I don't have ADD. I mean, God, I love you, Jason, but if I found out you had $2 million in cash in the trunk of that car tonight, I'd follow you home from the meeting. I have what's called selective interest disorder. Oh, come on. You ever call the connection and forget, please? Never. Never. I see a girl, a motorcycle, something I want. I have laser focus. Sounds good. Not true. I have an irritability, which means I'm quick to anger. I'm slow to forgive. I keep score in every relationship that I'm in, right? Anybody got the fault-finding mind? And then I got a discontentment of my spirit, which is even worse than all of it. Because it means that the shine wears off everything right away. It doesn't matter what I get. I got a brand new car. I've been saving all year for that car. I don't even get it off the dealer's lot. It's the wrong color. Right? I wanted the pearl. Get a new house? I'm not even out of escrow. Hate the neighbors. Hate them. Fucking dog. The dog, right? 3 a.m. I get a new job. I'm making more money I've ever made in my life. I start doing the math. Getting ripped off. Right? And you wonder why relationships are hard? So I start to see something in me. And what it is, and a lot of people come to AA, like the doctor's opinion said, they're normal in every respect except the effect produced by alcohol. Normal, able, friendly people, that's not who I am. In fact, what happens to me is so severe that once I stop drinking, it's almost like the outsides get better, the insides get worse. And the longest bridge I'm ever going to cross, the longest journey I will walk in recovery is that little dash between the first and second half of step one. It's telling me I got a body that can't process alcohol, but more importantly, I have a mind that cannot process reality. Not to my liking. So I got a body that can't drink and a mind that has to? You don't think that's a dilemma? And again, that's what the Al-Anons can't figure out about us. They can't figure out why we drink. We can't figure out why you don't. And I always thought, because I drink, therefore my life's unmanageable. That's like looking at the tip of an iceberg and seeing the ruined home, the broken marriage, the financial destitution, the failing health, and thinking that's the problem. In fact, that's what treatment tells me the problem is. That's why I'm sitting in another fancy treatment center in my nightgown, learning about my triggers. I'm like, excuse me, counselor, waking up's a trigger for me. I'm awake. Like, go back to your dorm, sir. They don't know what to do with me. And what AA is telling me is something totally different. It's telling me the trigger's on the inside. You ever notice when an alcoholic's not having a good day? It's when I'm not getting my way. Oh, come on. We're all like 5-year-old kids here with old people's faces. Oh, you don't believe it? Cross one of us. I'll resent you for decades. And your grandkids. But see, resentment in Latin means to refeel. It means consciously or subconsciously, I've taken an event from my past, I've attached emotion to it, then I refeel it, I recreate it, I replay it in every area of my life. My life becomes like spiritual Groundhog Day. And when he talks about, unless I can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of my recovery. And right next to being restless, irritable, and discontent, if you really look at 10, 11, and 12, 10 is peace, 11 is power, be still and know that I am God, 12 is purpose. That seems to be the message. And I didn't understand how powerful purpose was. And I'm going to finish with a couple of these things. I was at an airport recently. I get to fly a lot. And I'm standing at this gate, and I'm waiting for my plane. And this guy comes running up to me. He's wearing a slingshot T-shirt at the airport, full body tattoo. He's got the teardrops, the whole neck thing going. He's like, you don't remember me, do you, bro? I'm like, no, I don't remember you. I thought he was going to hit me up for money. It looked like he was going to stab me. And he's got these two beautiful kids with him, and this lady's by his side. And there's this awkward moment. And he looks me in the eye and he says, 15 years ago, you spoke on a prison panel and something you said changed my life. These are my beautiful daughters. This is my amazing wife. This is my family. We want to thank you. And all of a sudden, the faucet comes on. The wife's crying. Now the kids are crying. Now I'm crying. We're all crying. I mean, five seconds ago, it was like, I didn't know whether to run from this guy. Now we look like the long-lost family from the old country. I mean, it's weird. We're like hugging and, you know what I mean, like a football huddle. I remember calling my sponsor. My sponsor was like, Adam, you got a big mouth and a good memory. Don't let it go to your head. Click. But there's two dates in a human being's life. The day we're born. And the day we find out why. All my life, I thought it was about money, property, and prestige. Job, house, relationship, car, bigger job, different house, different relationship, bigger car, different job, different house. But see, puke smells the same in a Mercedes. If you have what I have, if you're a normal person, even a hard drinker, you can do it. You can fix up the outsides and maybe feel better about it. My experience all my life is I chase money, property, and prestige. What AA is telling me is to chase a spiritual life, and money, property, and prestige will chase me. Part of the word spiritual is ritual. In the therapeutic community, there's this thing called chop wood, carry water. I'm like, what does that mean? But see, if you live in a really cold climate, you know, if you don't chop wood every night, you freeze to death. You'll never do it twice when it's 30 below zero. If you don't bring water up from that river, you die. So in AA, it's similar. Go to meetings, work steps, help others. Go to meetings, work steps, help others. Go to meetings, get a job, work steps, help others. Go to meetings, work steps, maybe have a relationship, help others. Go to meetings, work steps, start a business, help others. Go to meetings, work steps, bury a parent, help others. Go to meetings, work steps, lose a business, get a divorce, get remarried, have a kid, lose, I don't know. All I know is I follow these simple spiritual actions. Go to meetings, work steps, help others. My head, my heart, and my feet moving in the same direction. And like a lot of us, people like us that were absolutely doomed. Someone like me that had lived in institutions for 17 years. Has peace, power, and purpose in my life. That's why I know this works. Maybe that's why I got invited here. I don't know. But I am with all my heart so grateful for that. And I'll say this last thing. When I got out of that 28th Residential Treatment Center, the guy that was running the hospital said to me, why don't you come back to our lovely hospital next week, tell all the patients here how you managed to stay sober an entire week, if you can make it. And then he threw me off the property. And I'm like, I was so mad. You know, we're sensitive, right? I was so mad at him that for the next 8.5 years, I sat in 2 hours of bumper-to-bumper traffic, right, to tell a bunch of strangers in a detox how I stayed sober another week. And guess what? I was tricked into service. It never occurred to me all the years I'd suffered with self-centeredness. That shyness. Was because I wasn't willing to give anything. See, it never occurred to me when Bill Wilson got out of that third treatment center, Towns Hospital, 1935, and he said he was a broken man, right? He was overcome with waves of depression. He'd lost everything in life worthwhile. And Bill got a real simple idea. Maybe if I go back in the hospital and talk to some of the patients, I'll feel better. That's all it was. And we know the story. He called Dr. Silkworth. Funny, Silkworth was a double board certified physician in psychiatry and neurology. At that time, he was the chief physician in the Western world that treated alcoholism. Trust fund babies from all over Europe used to come see Silkworth. Now they all go to L.A., right? The Rehab Riviera. But Silkworth says, if you read the doctor's opinion, it says, with all our synthetic knowledge, our ultra-modern standards, we're not well equipped. I got in my book, I can't fix you. I had the best psychiatry, the best therapy, the best MFTs. I had everything money could buy, just like Roland Hazard, the heir to Allied Chemical, who went to Carl Jung. They couldn't fix me. So when Bill asked him, I have this idea, I want to come back in the hospital and talk to some of the patients. Silkworth's like, you want to do what? He'd never heard of such an idea. But he allowed Bill Wilson, a layman, to come back into that hospital and talk to some of the patients. And what Dr. Silkworth witnessed from 1935 to 1939, in conjunction with what happened in Towns Hospital and then what happened in Akron, Dr. Silkworth said was absolutely amazing. He was so amazed by what he witnessed with Bill coming in that if you look at the first endorsement in the doctor's opinion where it says you can absolutely rely on anything these men say about themselves, that was a letter of credibility given to Bill Wilson by a double board certified physician on the Towns Hospital letterhead with his personal phone number. This double board certified physician risked his reputation on a newcomer. And what's so powerful if you're new is the question is this, what did Bill really know? See, you can have the mind of a king, but to have the heart of a servant. Bill had the heart of a servant. There's two kinds of people on this earth. There's guests and there's hosts. The guest is never happy, right? No onions on my burger. I asked for a king-size bed. I can't believe the rent-a-car. Right? What'd you get me for my birthday? Never happy. See, the host comes at life very differently. Bill knew very little, but Bill had a servant's heart. Bill was so broken by this grandiosity that he had, that it turned into humility. He became teachable. If you're new, I pray that you might be teachable. Maybe you guys do some step workshops. What happened to me is I got around some people that took me through the book that taught me some simple ideas and showed me how to help others. By 1942, he said, our chief responsibility to the newcomer is an adequate presentation of the program recovery. I don't know if I've been able to do that tonight, but I will thank Neil. I'll thank Jason. Thank Jeremy. Thank all of you. Thank you.